Well, it is true. I love stories of lost people that are found, especially when they involve out of somebody's passion, somebody going out and finding them. I remember a few years ago when those miners in Pennsylvania were trapped down in the ground and they started pulling them up out of the ground. What an incredible, you know, feeling that was. And then even, you know, a couple weeks ago, remember when that young Boy Scout in Utah was lost? And I remember thinking, oh, these stories, they never turn out well. You know, it never ends up well. And then after 4 days, after passionately looking for him, his parents and all these rescue parties, they found him. I remember kind of being so struck by that and thinking about, boy, what it must have felt like for that father of that son to have him lost and then have him back. And just as he kind of held him for the first time, what that must have felt like to that boy and what that must have felt like to that father. There's something about stories like that that just kind of moved me, in some way that nothing else does. And, maybe that's why, you know, when I get a chance to talk about my favorite passage of the Bible, the part that really has had a special effect on me in my life, I end up going back time and time again to the story of the prodigal son that Jesus told. You know, and a lot of people are familiar with it, but if you're not, you know, basic story, the soundbite is the son, asks for all of his part of the inheritance. He goes off, he squanders it, and then he comes back and he actually finds forgiveness at the end instead of judgment. And a phenomenal story, maybe Jesus' most well-known teaching. And it's one that has inspired a lot of artwork throughout time. It's inspired a lot of poetry, a lot of music, a lot of writing, sculpture, paintings, all kinds of stuff, because there's just something in it that seems to move people in a particular way that other stories don't. As a matter of fact, one of Rembrandt's most famous paintings, you may be familiar with it, was The Return of the Prodigal Son. This is a painting that Rembrandt did, one of the last paintings that he did in his life, toward the end of his life, and some feel that he actually painted himself into that painting as well. But that story so moved Rembrandt, that's one of the final paintings that he did in his life. And he's not the only one. You know, there have been a lot of artists that this story has moved, and I have to admit that one of them is me. I have used to sketch a lot all the way through about college, and then I kind of let it go. And in the last couple years, I've taken it up again and started kind of sketching again. As a matter of fact, I've been studying painting and I've been trying to learn, how to oil paint. I've always thought, man, if I could really paint well, that's pretty much the only thing I would want to paint. That's the only story that I really would want to put on canvas, would be this return of the prodigal son. And I've always imagined what did that father's face look like when he grabbed his son and he held his son that had been lost? And what kind of just crazy expression was on his face? So as I've started studying painting and I've been sketching a little bit, I got to the point, a little while ago, where you get to that kind of tender point, if you've ever created any art, where you kind of start to show it to other people. And, you take a little bit of risk and see what they think. So I've been sketching this, and I was sketching the face of the father, of what kind of grin I thought would have been on his face when he first held his son. I remember the first risk I took was Nancy was in the house, and she walked by my study, and she came in. I said, hey, hon, I want to show it to her. And I didn't give her any context for what it was whatsoever. I just want to kind of see her reaction and see if it moved her, in the way that it moved me. And she looked at it, and she laughed. She laughed. She gave. I said, "Well, what do you?" She says, "Well, it reminds me of how funny monkeys can be sometimes." I said, "Not exactly, kind of what I was looking for, out of my art." But then I gave her the context for what it was. She said, "Oh yeah, I can see that, kind of too." And I put it away for a couple days, and I went back, and when I looked at it, I realized I had created a rather haunting portrait of Dr. Zaius from Planet of the Apes, is basically, what I ended up with. And it was confirmed to me by a few weeks later. We're going through this exercise on staff. We're doing this activity together where we're all painting, kind of creating this mural together as we talked about, our images of God. And they said, just put in your own part, kind of what you think your image of God is. And I always think of the loving father from the prodigal son. So it's kind of in a very crude way, kind of painting that and as a reflection of that. And then one of our staff people came by and they looked at it and said, Brian's painting Chewbacca. What is that? It's not Chewbacca. And I realized that one of the key litmus tests for great art is you don't have to stand there and explain it to somebody of what it is. I couldn't see myself in any gallery standing and saying, no, it's not Chewbacca. This is the father, So I decided, I kind of learned to grow, and I got to get rid of this monkeyness of my people that I'm drawing in some way. I'm not sure. So I have evolved, a little bit. I do have one of my more recent works here that I wanted to share. Now, you can actually tell, I've lost the monkeyness, because a monkey would not wear a top hat, or at least would not be smiling if he was wearing a top hat. So I have decided, though, that maybe if I'm gonna share what I've learned from this, I probably should stick to words today instead of torturing you with my artwork. The thing about this story that so moves people is this picture that they see of this kind of love that they something in them yearns for. And they feel like something's been taken from them. They're not quite sure, but this is the kind of story that seems to restore that to them. But what I think is interesting is to fully appreciate the intensity of the story, you've got to understand a little bit of the context of what was going on. Who is Jesus talking to, and what was the context that he was describing this? Because almost exclusively, historians will tell you, they really know Palestine during the time of Jesus. They will say that the listeners of his story during this time would not have responded to the story as this warm, fuzzy, oh, isn't this wonderful, you know, kind of thing. The way they would have responded would be outrageousness. They would have been ticked off, and they would have been probably angry and at least outraged by the story. And here's why, a little bit of context. First of all, what happens is Jesus is responding to an accusation that's been made from him. It's important to know before you get into the story, Jesus responds with the story in response. What happens is the religious establishment of his day, the Pharisees, and started hearing about the teaching of Jesus and what he was doing. And they started to gather around as people were following Jesus around and listening to his teaching. And they started to be concerned not only for what Jesus was saying, but because they felt like this rabbi Jesus was attracting the wrong crowd of followers. They said, these are all the wrong people. These are the lawbreakers. These are the sinners that are all hanging out with Jesus. And that does not say good things about him. And so what happened was the Pharisees made this accusation about Jesus. And we see this here. We're going to pick up this story in the book of Luke, which Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, first four books of the New Testament of the Bible, they are the historical records of Jesus' life and his teaching while he was here on earth. So in the book of Luke, we have this account of Jesus telling this story, but we need to see the context of what happened that caused him to tell the story. So in Luke 15, 1 to 2, here's what it says. It says, now the tax collectors, and mind you, tax collectors at the time were the lowest of the low because they were the people who cheated people out of their money. They were thought, you know, they're absolutely no good. You couldn't get any lower in society than a tax collector. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him, talking about Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this being the religious establishment, they muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. That's interesting. First of all, you see here, they muttered. It's not like they came right out to Jesus and asked him to explain something. They just were kind of hanging around the back, and they just kind of muttered, this guy welcomes sinners and eats with them. And what we see here is Jesus' response to what happens. And what he responds with, he responds not just with the story of the lost son. He actually responds with three stories in a row. See, the prodigal son was never meant to be a story that you took just as a standalone thing. It was part of three points of the same story. Jesus responds to this accusation that he hangs out with sinners and he eats with them. He responds not with directly addressing the Pharisees, not stopping and then speaking right to them, but what he does is he responds and he starts telling these three stories. And just boom, 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 three in a row where he tells the stories. And, you know, where, and he starts off with talking about, you know, there was a shepherd who had 100 sheep and one of them became lost and he went out to find that one lost sheep. There was a woman who had 10 coins. She lost one. She spent all day looking for that one coin. And then when she found it, she grabbed her friends and celebrated. And then he tells the story of the lost son. And it's interesting that he gets challenged by the Pharisees here indirectly. This man hangs out with sinners, and he doesn't respond to them directly. He just says, you know, there was a man who had this sheep, and he just goes off. And how smooth of Jesus, you know, to not respond to them directly, but just immediately move into his teaching into these kind of three stories. And I thought, man, I wish I could do that. You know, you ever have somebody who says something antagonistic to you, you know, or is arguing with you, to not have to address them directly, but just kind of, you know, kind of look off into space and say, you know, there was a man who had a son, you know, and I thought about, you know, doing that with Nancy. You know, Nancy might say, hey, hon, are you going to take the trash out today? And I could say, there was a woman who had a coin, you know, and or get pulled over by the police, you know, and then they come up to the window and they ask, of course, that million-dollar question, which how are you going to respond? You know, sir, do you know why we pulled you over? You know, that I would be able to say, you know, there was a man, officer. He was a good man. He was in a hurry because he was doing the Lord's work, you know, and just never works for me. Never works for me, because I'm, realized, I'm not Jesus, you know, is why I realize it doesn't work. But that's what Jesus does. He comes back, he tells a story, and it's interesting. He tells three stories, all part of the same point, where he's telling stories of lost things that have immense value. Lost things that are so valuable that the person that lost them drops everything to go find them. The shepherd who loses just one of his 100 sheep, and he drops everything and goes after that one lost sheep. The woman who loses one coin and spends all day looking for it. And then he gets to this third point of, you know, this trilogy of stories in response to this accusation that Jesus hangs out with the wrong people. And so we pick that up here in verse 11. Jesus continued. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. We see here, you know, it's interesting here that the son comes to the father and says he wants his share of the estate. Now, we need to understand what was going on here, because this seems, you know, kind of unusual, but doesn't seem really scandalous to us these days, because, you know, often today, elderly parents will sometimes start to pass on part of their inheritance to their children while they're still alive. And sometimes the elderly parents are the ones that they actually initiate that, you know, without even anybody asking them to. Not so in the day of Jesus' time in Palestine. This would have been an absolutely outrageous request, because here's the context. This son, you know, is one of two sons in the family. He had access, as one of the sons of the father, he had access to everything that the father had. He had equal use of the entire property. He benefited from all the cattle, you know, whatever food they raised, you know, the servants, all the riches, you know, kind of everything. He had access to everything this father had, whether it was the cattle, you know, the house, it was the, you know, the condo in Hilton Head, the jet skis, you know, everything. He could use all of it. He had equal access to all of it. But what he would be saying here by going to his father was he was going to be saying, that's not enough. You see, Dad, what I want is, I want all the stuff, like now, I want access to all the stuff, but I want it without you. You see, I want your stuff, I just don't want you, Dad. So what, in essence, what he was saying to his dad is, I would like it to be, not it is now, where I have access to all the stuff, but I'm also with you. I want it to be like it'll be when you're dead. I want all the stuff, but I don't want you. And so really, in fact, that's what he was asking him. And Jesus' listeners of this time would have known this, and they would have reacted with outrage of a son just does not bring that kind of shame on his father, that kind of injury, that kind of insult toward his father. There's an author who for 40 years lived in the Middle East while he was writing. And one of the, his name's Ken Bailey. And while he was living in the Middle East and studying and teaching, he did some intense study of the prodigal son. And he used to go out in the villages that he was living in, and he used to dialogue with people about this story. And it's interesting what he found when it came to this piece of the story. And here's what Ken Bailey says. For over 15 years, I've been asking people of all walks of life, from Morocco to India, from Turkey to the Sudan, about the implications of a son's request for his inheritance while the father is still living. The answer has always been emphatically the same. The conversation goes as follows. Has anyone ever made such a request in your village? Never. Could anyone ever make such a request? Impossible. If anyone ever did, what would happen? His father would beat him, of course. Why? This request means he wants his father to die. And so the response across the board is that if the son would ask this thing within Palestinian culture, even recently, if not, you know, when Jesus died, he was asked, making a request, like, Dad, I want things to be just like they'll be when you're dead. And out of that kind of outrageous, scandalous request, that's where we see the father's response here, that any good father of his time, his response would have been to slap his son. His response would have been to beat his son for the shameful request that he was making and for the insult that he was hurling at him. Not so what happens here, though. Because, you know, it said in that last line of what we looked at, it said, so, you know, his father divided his property between them. So his father not only doesn't beat him, but he grants his request. And when it says he divided his property between them, what it means is it's not just like the, you know, the father kind of cashed out some stock and gave his son some money. He had to liquidate a large part of his estate. You know, most people estimate between somewhere 40 to 50%. He had to liquidate of all his holdings, he had to liquidate so that his son could take that value and take it with him to go. And so this father does not respond to this outrageous request with a punishment, with a beating. He actually grants the request. And then here's what happens, picking it up in verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to fill to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. So we see the father doesn't respond with a slap. He responds by granting the son's request, and then the son takes his liquidated part of the estate. He goes out, and then he squanders it, and then famine hits. Not only has he squandered, and it's, you know, describes it as loose living, not only has he squandered everything that he has in loose living, but then a famine hits the land, and he's in a rough place. Can't even feed himself. This is where the outrageousness becomes even greater for Jesus' listeners, because it's very interesting, this tale that Jesus chooses, the occupation that he now chooses for the lost son. What's it say that he does? He needs food, so he goes and he puts himself under in the employ of an owner where he feeds the guy's pigs. And here's what you need to know about this. You know, at that time, and then a large part for today, you know, when you look at Palestine, you look at the Jewish people there, pigs were absolutely unclean animals. So they would not eat pork. They would not even associate with a pig, you know, even touch a pig in any way. So if this son has gone to work for somebody taking care of their pigs, he has gone to work for a Gentile. He has gone to work for someone that is outside of the Jewish faith, which was, you know, just kind of a further ultimate slap in his father's face. And not only that, but he does the most dirtiest job that a Jew could possibly do at that time. He takes care of pigs. Now, here's why that's important. There was a tradition there at the time that said that it was one thing to waste what you had, but if you took your possessions, particularly if you took your family's value, and you gave that property to a Gentile, so not only did it leave your family, but it left the Jewish faith. If you gave your property to a Gentile, you were to be cut off from your family. As a matter of fact, you were to be cut off from your village. There was a ceremony they would do called the Ketzasa. And the kasasa would be pretty much come into place two times. One would be is if a son would give his property away to a Gentile or would sell his property to a Gentile, or is if you married a woman outside of the faith. And so what they would do is if they did this, they would do this kasasa where the family would get together and they would take this parched corn and nuts and they would put them in a jar. And then they would go out somewhere public and they would take that jar and they would smash it. And let's say the son's name was Joseph. They would smash this jar in the Ketzasa ceremony, and they would say, Joseph is now cut off from his family, Ketzasa. Joseph is now cut off from his village. And the only way to restore, the only way to return someone from being cut off would be as if that person would turn around and get that property back from the Gentiles and bring it back within the family, bring it back within the village. So what had happened was this son had not only squandered his stuff, but he'd done it among Gentiles, and he had lost everything, so now he was at the point of no return. There is no way he could restore being cut off because he had lost the things that he had sold to the Gentiles, and he had lost all the money that he had gotten because of it. And so he knows that if he returns, he faces the kasasa. If he comes back, not only for the shame he's brought on his family, but for the way that he's gone about this, he will be officially cut off. And he hits famine, and he doesn't know what to do. And so we pick it up here, and he starts to think about, what can I possibly do about this? This place that I've come, this I know coming back, I face this cutting off. Not only will I be cut off from my family, but my entire village. And he starts to think about what he can do. Verse 17. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he starts to plan. You know what? Entirely appropriate response of his. He knows entirely logically he is no longer worthy to be called his father's son. He knows he is deserving of the ketzasa. He knows that what he has done has brought shame on his family and probably his entire village. And to go back, he has no rights to anything. But he starts to plan. And he starts to kind of get this idea and say, well, maybe if I go back and I prepare this very eloquent speech, admitting what I had done wrong, and then saying, I know I will never be your son again, but could I at least be one of your hired servants? And maybe over time I can work this off. So he puts together, you know, this very kind of tight performance plan that's going to start with the speech and then go to working as a servant, and he's going to perform, and through what he does, he's going to be able to get himself over time by achieving enough brownie points into his father's good graces. And so he prepares the speech, he prepares the performance plan, and he starts to go back, and he's bracing for the slap now. He knows he's going to get back, and he's going to come back, and he's going to get what his due. So he's bracing for the slap, he's bracing for this cutting off that will happen. And here's what happens. So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. See, he's got the speech ready. He's got the speech because he knows this does not, I have no rights to anything, and I have got to get ready for the slap. I know this is still going to come. It says his father, though, said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Now, it's interesting here. Now we have the outrageousness and the shame and the scandal of this arrogant son's request. And Jesus' listeners had become so outraged to that. And now they see something even more outrageous, which is the strange kind of father they're seeing who's able to respond to this insult, respond to this harm with more love. And this elderly patriarch of this family runs to this scandalous son. And what we know of at the time is elderly men did not run to anyone. You know, patriarchs didn't get up and even walk to anyone. People came to them. They did not run to anyone. So much so, there's an old quote from Aristotle. Aristotle said, he said, great men never run in public. You know, they don't run because it shows that they need something more than it needs them. The great men don't run in public. Which obviously Aristotle was never 20 minutes late for his connection at O'Hare. You know, that's obvious for one thing. But you know, it was known, great men do not run. And so what we see is this elderly patriarch, he's waiting for, he sees his son, and while his son is still far off, he gathers up his robe and he holds it, and then he runs to him, and like a giddy teenager, he runs to this son and he throws his arms around him. His son is braced for the kasasa. He's prepared for the slap. He's prepared for the beating. He's got his performance plan, and instead of his performance plan, he finds this strange love. And it's strange for two reasons to us. First of all, it's strange to find somebody who is just so openly giddy about someone, you know, that they're in love with. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, kind of that weird, funky thing with Tom Cruise, you know, kind of in the last month, where you're like, what is up with this? And, you know, Katie Holmes is not bad, but this is Tom Cruise, for goodness sake, you know, please, I don't know what's going on here. But one of the things that's so upset people is he's just giddy like a teenager about this. And we think, you know what, we're not used to that kind of expression of love. But the other thing is, this is a love that is also a very seasoned love. Along with this strange giddiness, it's a very seasoned kind of love that can take an insult and respond with more love. It's a kind of seasoned love that can take a hit and come back with more love. And we're just not used to seeing the combination of those two things together. We're not used to seeing this kind of love, particularly out of a father. And I think this is where this story kind of gets lost for a lot of us, because we see this image, character that Jesus has created in the story of a father, and we have such a hard time kind of thinking about it in this way, a lot of times because the shadow of our own fathers get in the way when we see God using terminology and images of himself in a father-like position with us. And we may have, you know, at some point thought of our dads in this way. You know, I think at some point, you know, early in our life, we kind of think our dad, you know, kind of is just everything. I know my son John just turned 10, and he started to kind of get into a little bit more mature, kind of seasoned place now. But when he was about 4 or 5, I was just it. I was everything to him. He just thought I was, you know, the coolest thing in the world, you know. And I remember after dinner often I had this trick where after dinner I would take the paper napkin, I would kind of press it up closely against my face, and then I would stick my tongue through it, you know. And he'd say, oh, that's killer. Oh, he just, every time. I could, it was like the 170th time I did it, and it just killed him. He just thought, oh, that's, Dad is just the coolest. Or I would teach him things like it is possible to gargle with Jell-O, you know, and he's just so amazed, you know, at kind of everything I did. You know, he was cheap, he was fun, and he was easily impressed. I had decided, I found the ultimate date, you know, finally, and, you know, kind of my young son. So much so that when we first started talking to him about God and explaining things about God and everything, he would get a little confused sometimes when he was dressing me. And, you know, at the house he would say, hey, God, I mean Dad. You know, and he did this kind of more than once. I said, well, you know, that's understandable. But let me kind of help you here. It is interesting, though. You know, in almost 14 years of marriage, Nancy has never once made that kind of mistake. She's just so disciplined about her thought life, I think. You know, I don't know how she's done it. So we're not used to, in a mature way, seeing a father in this way. And I think for some of us, it's really hard for us to imagine this kind of outrageous, strange, giddy love that a father would have for us. Because a lot of us, you know, we may have received more injury than anything in that. Which is a really hard thing to unravel later in life. You know, Blaise Pascal talked about what happens in a relationship that has a high potential for intimacy. And here's what he said. He said, the greater the potential in a relationship for intimacy, the greater the potential for disappointment. And when you think about it, what could have a greater potential for intimacy than a father and his son? Or than a father and his daughter? And I just want to tell you, I think a lot of us in here have a hard time imagining this strange, outrageous, scandalous love that our Father God has for us because of our imperfect earthly fathers that we've had. And a lot of us here see this story, and maybe we can't quite articulate it, but in the end, what we end up feeling, we can't connect to it because we've never gotten that kiss. We've never gotten that father runs. We've never gotten the kiss. And I want to tell you in here today, if you are an adult and you kind of think about the story and you respond in that way and you realize that you've never gotten the kiss of a father like that, first of all, I just want to tell you, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We have imperfect fathers, and sometimes damage is done. And I also want to tell you, and I want to be really tender about this, but I want to tell you, you're going to have to get to the place where you realize you may never get that. You may never get that. I think a lot of us, the major thing that gets in our way of understanding the scandalous love that God has for us is the imperfect relationship we've had with our own fathers. And I know it can run the gamut from mild disappointment to significant abuse. But there is restoration and there is healing that our Father God provides for us, because what God says in the Bible, he's very clear that dads are there to be a model and to share God's love, but they are conduits of God's love to us. They are not the source of love for us. They are just supposed to be a channel through which God's love flows to us. And God, very specific ways in the Bible, he chooses wording where he says, you know what? If your dad didn't do that for you, I will find another way. I am a father to the fatherless. I am a defender of widows. I set the lonely into families. And God says these words to say, you know what? Your dad's supposed to be a channel of love to you, but if in his imperfect way he couldn't do it, maybe he never received it himself, I can funnel that love to you in other ways. And you need to know today that if your dad is a shadow in this story, you need to know that it doesn't have to be so. I actually would like to just kind of take just a little break in the message here, you know, right now. And I just want to say a prayer over us that have received these kind of wounds. And I can't pretend, you know, 1,000 people in here right now, I can't pretend what nature the wounds take. I can't pretend to know that. I can't pretend to know your dad's. All I can know is I can know what God has promised to us in his outrageous love. I just want to take, you know, just kind of a minute in the middle of the story, and I just want to say a prayer for us. God, only Only you know the potential for intimacy with our own dads that's fallen short. And God, we don't come to you today laying everything on our parents. Some of them brought everything that they had, brought the best that they had to us, but they did it in imperfect ways. But God, what we come to you is we come to you claiming that comfort and that healing that in particular you offer those who in different ways have been fatherless. And so God, I claim right now, as you tell us you are the God of all comfort, I pray that right now in a very real way, like never before, those of us in here that have been wounded by the very people that were to take care of us, I pray, God, that we would feel the arms of our loving Father around us like we never have before. God, I pray right now that everyone would feel that kiss. And you'd help us see the relationship that you, as our Father, that is just crazy in love with us, that you run to us. And that we would feel your arms right now. Amen. You know, the thing is, even though fathers are given to us as this model that are supposed to represent God's love to us, fathers are very inadequate models for doing that because we're imperfect people. You know, and I know in ways I'm partially aware of and not even totally aware of, I know I'm probably screwing up my kids in my own, you know, kind of special way right now. And I need to know. I need to feel the heaviness of that. I need to feel the significance of what it means to father children and to raise them. At the same time, I also need to feel God's grace on me as a father and know that I'm an imperfect person and that I am not called to be God to those children. I am called to just share God's love that he's given me. It's interesting, though, because now there's a point in the story where things turn. Remember what Jesus was responding to with these stories. He was responding to this accusation from the religious establishment that he hang out with sinners and he partied with them, was basically, you know, what their accusation was. And this story now turns a little bit because, you know, what Jesus is saying by showing this father who not only accepts his son back, but he runs out to them. And notice the words that are there again and again. It says, this son that was found. He doesn't say this son that found his way home. He says the son that was found. There's a very real words that are used there to describe, I went out and found him. I went out and got him. Yeah, he might have been on the way back, but I went out and got him. And then I threw this big party for him. And what Jesus is saying to these religious establishment, he's saying, you know what, folks? Do I hang out with the wrong people? You know what? I got to tell you, it's even worse than that. I do all that and more. As a matter of fact, you know what happens? I go out and get them. I run out and get them, and I bring them in. And you know what? I pay for the kegs. I throw the party. Jesus says, folks, you need to understand, it's even worse than you think. But he says there's something else because Jesus doesn't stop with the story there. And many scholars believe this was actually his point of the story. We haven't even gotten to his point yet. This is his point of the story because what the father does is he doesn't go out just once. He goes out twice. And we find him now going out again. Because the father has more than one son. Verse 25. And 28 to 30. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, now we have new information, don't we? Yeah. Why is it that his older brother knows this and nobody else does? You know, how did... He's got connections. He talks to people, I guess. I don't know. But when the son of yours has squandered... Not why my brother, but when the son of yours has squandered your property with prostitutes, come home, you kill the fattened calf for him. It's notice here that Jesus says what the father did was that he went out to the son. He goes out again. You see, a lot of people say, you know, this is the story of the lost son. Others say, you know what? No, it should be called the story of the lost sons. There's more than one son that's lost here. The father has to go out to the older son as well. Because here's what's going on here. You know, we have this breakage of relationship between the son and the father. And we see that in two cases here. We see it through the younger son who's run off. You know, he's broken all the rules and he's broken his relationship with his dad. But now we see in this part of the story, remember who Jesus is talking to? He's talking to the good folks. He's talking to the religious establishment. He says there's another son whose relationship is just as broken. The first son broke the relationship with his father, which the Bible would call sin. That's what sin is when we go against what God's plan is for us. But what Jesus seems to be saying here is we can sin in two ways. We sin when we use the rules, either breaking them. So the younger son broke the rules, the way to show his own independence, to say he was in control. We can sin when we use the rules, either breaking them or keeping them to make ourselves in control. And so what the older son had been doing, he's saying, I've kept the rules. I've done everything you need. I've slaved for you. I've done it. And notice the words that he used, they're slaved for you. There's no love here. And he says, I have slaved for you. I have kept the rules. I've done all this kind of stuff. And now I am entitled. And the older son has felt this growing bitterness and this growing sense that he's not getting his fair share. And it comes out in his relationship with his father is just as broken as the younger son's was. And what Jesus seems to be saying here in his response to the religious establishment, saying you hang out with the wrong people, what he seems to be saying is you need to be careful. There's more than one way to be lost. Your goodness, your morality, your keeping all the rules can just be a way. You stayed home, but you did it so you could be in control. And so you're such a nice rule keeper, but you look down your nose on those who have broke the rules, and you think you have this entitlement to things, and it's your goodness, it's your morality that's getting in the way of you and your father, and you are just as lost. There's a pastor in New York City by the name of Tim Keller that I think is just absolutely brilliant. And here's his take on this part of what Jesus is teaching here. He says, this is an absolute in-your-teeth warning to good people. Jesus is saying nothing comes between you and God like your morality, your goodness, your decency, and your respectability. See, there's two lost sons here. I think probably the older son is the one, though, with the bigger problem. Because, see, he's lost, and he doesn't know it. He's lost, but by staying at home, by being a rule keeper, he doesn't even know that he's lost. And so what he's done is what a lot of rule keepers do, is they define themselves by the rules, and they say, this is me, so this is you, and then they immediately go to, this is the not you. So this is you, and then this is the not you. And the not you are the people who don't do things the way that you would. And so you define yourself, and then it's a very easy slip to you and then disdaining and looking down on the not you. And I believe this is a major source of hatred and strife in our world today, is the you and the not you. And two groups of older brothers defining themselves against the others. And imagine what happens when this kind of attitude becomes institutionalized. I mean, it's this kind of thing with older brothers that in some parts of the world they call Jews and Arabs. Some parts of the world they call Serbs and Croats. Some parts of the world they call Hutus and Tutsis. Some parts of the world they call black and white. Some parts of the world they call liberal and conservative. Some parts of the world they call Republican and Democrats. This is the you and this is the not you, and I will look down on all the not yous. And that's the older brother mindset. The older brother mindset is basically this, that there are two kinds of people in the world, those that are sinful and worthless and those that are good and valuable. And what Jesus seems to be blowing apart with this story is that whole dichotomy and says that's not it. It's not that there's two groups of people in the world, sinful and worthless and good and valuable. There's only one kind of person in the world, sinful and valuable. And so he tells in these three stories, all of which things that are lost, some on their own accord, they're lost, but so stinking valuable that the person drops everything to go after them. Jesus says there's only one kind of person, sinful and of incredible value. And that's what makes this such strange love from this father picture he paints. And that's where, if you look at the story shouldn't even be called the lost son or lost sons. Look at where Jesus started with the context of the story in the first place. There was a man who had two sons. The story's about the man. The focus is not on the focus is on the Father here. And you need to know, I don't know where you find yourself today. Maybe you find yourself feeling lost. Maybe you find yourself feeling there's no way I could ever come back to a responsible place with my Creator. You don't know the things that I've done. Maybe though you sit here and maybe instead of that you've been a rule keeper. And maybe you've had some growing older brotherness growing in you, where you've been doing the right thing. Maybe you were a younger brother, and now you've been doing the right thing, but instead of what's happening to you is less and less increasing joy and gratitude in your life, and more a feeling, this vague, nebulous feeling that you're just kind of not getting what's due. And so you've had this growing older brother bubbling in you. What you need to know, wherever you find yourself today, is that what Jesus says is it's not about either one of those. What it is about is the Father. It is about the strange, scandalous love of this Creator of the universe who knows every dirty little thing about you and loves you. Wherever you find yourself in this story today, the question you just need to ask yourself is, will I respond to this pursuing, crazy love that's coming after me? Let's pray. God, help us feel this completely illogical love that you have for us. That wherever we find ourselves in this story, you are coming out after us. And help us respond, God, not with a speech, but just with feeling your arms around us. We pray this in Jesus' name.